Hey, thank you, man. So good morning, Jamestown. As Abby and Don have said, my name's Jeremy. Excited to be here with you this morning. And happy second winter, right? Like, you remember like first spring, what was it, Wednesday or Thursday? There was like 12 hours that were beautiful. And then this morning we woke up to second winter. And you ever realize like second winter is different than first winter, right? Like first winter is pretty. You take out your phone, you take pictures, the snow. Second winter is not pretty. Second winter is just cold. But it's here. So welcome to second winter. So I'm excited for what we're going to jump into this morning. We're going to look at a passage this morning that honestly, it's one of those passages that I struggled with for a good chunk of my life because it's just a confusing passage. It's one of those passages that like when I entered seminary, you know that eventually like you're going to stand on a stage like this and you're going to open the scriptures and share something with a room of people. And this was always one of those passages that it was like, I hope I never get like assigned that one because that passage, I just didn't know what to do with it. Because the passage we're going to look at this morning, it's a story. It's a story where Jesus kind of like, he kind of messes something up. Like he tries to do something. It doesn't work. And then Jesus, like, he has to like fix it. He has to like do it again. And for years, we'll look at it in a minute, but for years, I always struggled. What do I do? How would I preach a story where Jesus kind of messes something up? It didn't make sense to me for a long time. And so if you want to follow along, we will be on Mark chapter 8. So we'll be in Mark 8 if you want to follow along. We will put all the words on the screen. But before we jump there, just a little bit, just a couple words on kind of where we're at kind of in a series. We are kind of right in the middle of a series where we're looking at the book of Mark. The book of Mark, we call it a gospel. Gospel comes from the Greek word euangelion. Euangelion means good news. So the gospel of Mark is this declaration of good news of Jesus, the story, a biography of Jesus, written by a guy by the name of Mark. And so we're kind of walking through Mark a little bit differently than we do some series. Some series we start at the beginning and then we just kind of like follow the book. So Mark 1 goes to Mark 2, goes to Mark 3, and we just kind of make our way through it. This one's a little bit different because what we're doing is we're essentially asking the question of Mark. If Mark's agenda is that he wants to write this story so that you can come to know who Jesus is, we're kind of asking the question of Mark, what are the important things? Those things that Mark says, in order to understand Jesus, you need to understand this. And so instead of kind of going chronologically through Mark, we're kind of jumping around a little bit, kind of picking out some of those pieces, asking that question, what are the things that Mark says? If you're going to understand Jesus, you need to nail these things down. You need to know these. And so this morning, we are in Mark chapter 8. We're going to read the story kind of in its entirety. And I think you're going to catch the problem that I'd had for years with the story. Let's jump in. Mark chapter 8, starting at verse 22. It says, they, which is Jesus and the disciples, they came to Bethsaida, and some people brought a blind man and begged Jesus to touch him. He took the blind man by the hand and led him outside of the village. So Jesus takes him outside. When he had spit on the man's eyes and put his hands on him, Jesus asked, do you see anything? He looked up and said, I see people. They look like trees walking around. Once more, Jesus put his hands on the man's eyes. Then his eyes were opened, his sight was restored, and he saw everything clearly. Jesus sent him home saying, don't even go into the village. Do you see my problem with the story? Right, there's the problem with the story, but then even on top of the problem with the story, can we just name that like the story is kind of just, if we're honest, it's a little bit gross and weird, isn't it? Like it's a little weird, it's odd, and parts of it are if we're honest, a little bit gross. Like can we just be grateful for the advances in modern eye medicine, right? Like Jesus, so first off, Jesus, this blind man is brought before Jesus, and Jesus responds by spitting into the man's eyes. Can you imagine? You go to the eye doctor, they've got the little like eye doctor face thing, right? And it's like, is option A or option B? And option B, they just hock a loogie. Like, of course option A is better. What are you talking? What are we doing? And yet, Jesus' first instinct, and Mark doesn't even like act like this is weird, but Jesus has brought this blind man, spits in his eyes. Why? Well, just to kind of deal with the spit side a little bit, like in Jesus' world, spit wasn't understood as gross as what we think of it today. There's actually considered to be like a medicinal quality to spit. And then there's a fun story that will come later. There's a story that'll come later, kind of around the time that Mark is writing. It has to do with, there's this Egyptian god, a god by the name of Serapis. And Serapis was said to have healed a blind man, restored sight, with the spit of a Roman emperor, a guy by the name of Vespasian. If you're not like up to date with your emperors, essentially Vespasian is the guy, he doesn't immediately follow Nero, but Nero was the crazy emperor. Nero was one of the emperors that Rome actually made a decision to erase his memory from history. He was that terrible. So Nero put Rome into chaos. Vespasian is the guy who would follow, who would kind of stabilize Rome for the first time on the back end of Nero. And if you know anything about the Caesars, to Rome, they saw these people as more than just rulers. They're more than just kings. These people, they understood, had like the blood of the gods in them. They were divine. They were gods in the flesh. And so this story would circulate later, almost as propaganda, as a, hey, is Vespasian, like with everything that happened with Nero, like, are we sure Vespasian's the guy? The story started as propaganda of like, well, I heard that Serapis used his spit to give a blind man sight as a way of proving that, yes, he is one of the gods. So is Jesus used his spit? Is it just because like there was a medicinal quality understood in his day? But is it possible that Jesus also does what he does, and Mark tells it the way Mark does, as a way of questioning, okay, who is actually king? Who actually sits, who actually carries the blood of the gods in them? And so Jesus, he spits on the guy's eyes. The next weird thing to me in the story, did you notice Jesus asks the guy if it worked? Like he spits in his eyes and he asks the question, hey, do you see anything? To me, that also feels weird. Because our Gospels, we have four of them. So we've got Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. They tell the story of Jesus. And there's a number of times Jesus will heal people in the Gospels. And almost never does Jesus ask if it works. Like, there's a story. Jesus, there's some friends of a guy. This guy we call him the paralytic. He's paralyzed. He can't walk. His friends bring him to Jesus. Jesus then says some words. And then what Jesus doesn't do is like, hey, can you wiggle your toes? Like, did it work? Can you do it? But instead what Jesus says is, hey, get up, take your mat and walk home. Jesus will raise people from the dead. We have a story of this young boy, the only son of this mother, and Jesus will speak some words. And what Jesus doesn't say is like, hey, can somebody check for a pulse? Like, is he breathing? No, what Jesus says is, hey, get up, join your mom, and go home. Jesus will raise his friend Lazarus. Lazarus, he's been dead for 4 days. He's in a tomb. Jesus will say some things. And then what Jesus doesn't do is like, hey, can you hear me? Like, did it work? No, Jesus just tells him like, hey, how about you come out? And yet in our story, Jesus spits in a guy's eyes. And then he asks him the question like, hey, did it work? Like that feels like a question like I would ask if I spit in his eyes, right? Like that doesn't feel like a question Jesus should be asking after Jesus does what he does. So why does Jesus ask the question? And then there's the question of the guy's response, because that also feels odd to me. This man who is blind says, well, I see, but people look like trees walking around. So which begs the question, if he's blind, how does he even know what a tree looks like, right? How does he know that? Well, maybe he wasn't born. Well, maybe he wasn't blind his entire life. Maybe he knows. Maybe. And then the question, like, well, if people look like trees, do trees look like people? Because that sounds terrifying. But what is why that response? And it all kind of boils down to my big question of the text, my biggest question of the story, the biggest problem I had with the story for years, which is simply, did Jesus mess up? Did he mess up? Did he do it wrong? Because, like, he tried, like, he spit on the guy's eyes, he put his hands on him. Did it work? And the guy's like, kind of, but it still isn't great. And then Jesus touches him again, and now he can see. Did Jesus mess up? And for years, I tried to find an answer to that question. I did some study. I looked into what other people had said about the passage. And what you find is scholars, theologians often get really uncomfortable with that question, right? The idea that Jesus would mess something up. And so what you find is, what I found at least, is I found a number of ways that people tried to, like, answer away this question. Did Jesus mess up? And so I want to share with you some of kind of the dominant answers that I had seen and kind of why they never quite made sense to me. Like, they didn't quite do it for me. And so answer number one to did Jesus mess up is, well, maybe Jesus is still learning. Like, maybe healings are hard. And so maybe Jesus is, like, he's trying to figure it out. Right, we're in Mark 8. Mark is 16 chapters long, so we're like halfway in, but we're kind of early in some of Jesus' healing. So, like, maybe he's trying to figure it out. And I, on the one hand, I'm okay with the idea that Jesus learned things. Jesus was born, he grew. The scriptures tell us that Jesus grew in wisdom and stature. I'm okay with Jesus learning things. Like, when Jesus was born, like, Jesus wasn't the first, like, infant astrophysicist, right? Like, this infant that knows everything about. Jesus learns. But does it make sense of the story that Jesus is, like, he's still trying to figure out this whole healing bit? And so, like, he kind of messes up because he's learning. And, like, he kind of got the wires crossed, but he'll learn from it. And then in the future, he'll be able to do really well. I never bought the answer. Do you buy the answer? The answer, it doesn't feel like it explains the story to me. So that was one of the first answers. Second answer that I'd stumbled into is, well, maybe eyes are just harder to heal than other things. Maybe eyes are just that much more complicated. And like the first one, like, on the one hand, I can get behind the premise a little bit. Eyes are complicated. A couple weeks ago, I was at a Hudsonville basketball game, and I was sitting next to friends of mine. They're eye doctors. And so I started by asking, like, okay, what does a typical day in an eye doctor's, like, day look like? And they explained. And then I got to the question of, like, okay, what's some of the craziest days in eye doctor? And they were explaining some of the surgeries. Like, whew, part of me wants to job shadow. The other part of me knows I'm passed out, like, 5 minutes into this thing, right? Like, I'm one of those guys, like, I can touch my eye, I wear contacts, but the idea of taking a scalpel to an eyeball, like, bleh. So eyes are complicated. I get that. That makes sense. But it also doesn't make sense as an answer to the story that, like, it's easier to heal eyes than it is other things, as if legs are super simple to heal, right? Like, I watched the Olympics. I've seen the contraption on Lindsey Vonn's leg. Like, nothing on that looks simple. I don't buy that it's because eyes are more complicated. That doesn't work for me. And then there was the question kind of on top of all the other questions. You notice where Jesus heals the blind man. Like, he is approached by this blind man. He then brings him outside of the village. Why? Is it because Jesus was worried it might not work? And so, like, I'm okay kind of messing up in front of my friends, but, like, in front of the whole town, like, that'd just be a little bit embarrassing. Like, why does Jesus bring him outside of the village? And then the moment it turned for me is I wasn't given an answer. The moment it turned for me is I was actually given a question to my question. So my question of, like, did Jesus mess up? Often it feels like sometimes questions are better answers than answers are, in my experience. And so I was given a question to my question. And this question, it would lead me on a journey. It'd lead me on this, like, deep dive. that at the end of it, all of the pieces all of a sudden kind of lined up and made sense. That question is the question, what if Jesus did it on purpose? What if when Jesus spit on the man's eyes, put his hands on him, what if when Jesus asked, like, hey, did it work? What if Jesus wasn't surprised by the response? What if it's what Jesus wanted? What if the whole story Jesus orchestrated on purpose? This question, it led me, like I said, it led me on a journey on this deep dive. And so what I want to do in our time this morning is kind of bring you along on that journey. And my hope is at the end of it, you, like me, will then look at that story and all of a sudden all of the pieces fit. But in order to start there, we need to talk just a little bit about kind of like how we read the Bible. Because too often, I think we could take a passage like we did this morning. We've got five verses in the middle of the book of Mark, and we can assume that all we need to understand this story is simply those five verses in the middle of the book of Mark. Mark, remember, 16 chapters. We took five verses in the middle of chapter 8, and too often, again, I think we think we can take those five verses, and that's all we need. But the reality is, the book of Mark, or the scriptures as a whole, aren't just a collection of disjointed stories, but Mark, in his gospel, in his account, Mark is telling a story. Mark is building something. And so sometimes when we just take five verses and say that's all we need, we might miss the larger story that Mark is telling. Let me give you a couple examples. Let's pretend you're going to go to a movie, and all you are going to do, you're going to show up halfway through the movie, watch 5 minutes, and then leave. Does it make sense that you think you could get the entire plot line of the movie? No. Do we have any like OG Lion King fans in the house? Any? All right. So let's pretend you showed up just for like 5 minutes in the middle of the movie. So you show up and you have this like baby lion Simba like running and dancing and singing songs with his friends Timon and Pumbaa. And if this is all you watch of the movie, you leave assuming the movie The Lion King is about these three friends in a jungle casting off life's worries, right? Hakuna Matata. That's the point of the movie. And in doing so, you would miss the entire plot line of the entire movie. Let's bring it maybe a little more current. If you're going to go watch Inside Out, all you watch is like 5 minutes in the middle. You leave thinking like, oh, sadness is the villain. And you'd miss the entire plot line of the story. And yet, too often we come to the scriptures and we say, well, I'm going to take five verses in the middle of the book of Mark, and those five verses are all I need to understand what Mark is saying. When maybe, just maybe, we need to step back from those five verses and ask, okay, what is the larger story Mark is telling? So kind of step one on our journey is to step back. We're in Mark chapter 8. So I want to back up even just to the beginning of Mark chapter 8. Because Mark 8, it starts with a pretty popular story. Let's go ahead and put a timeline. So Mark 8 starts with a story that we call the feeding of the 4,000. So Jesus in the story, Jesus is in the Decapolis, the Gentile region. That means a lot for the story, but that is a whole extra sermon. So unless we want to like DoorDash lunch and just go after it. But Jesus is, he's in the Decapolis region. Jesus has been teaching for about 3 days. Jesus looks out at the crowd and realizes, oh, they're hungry, because that's what happens when you've been listening to somebody for 3 days. So Jesus then says, hey, we should do something about it. And he asks his disciples, how many loaves of bread do we have? His disciples say, well, we've got seven loaves. And then we read this. It says, Jesus told the crowd to sit down on the ground. When he had taken the seven loaves and given thanks, he broke them and gave them to his disciples to distribute to the people, and they did so. They had a few small fish as well. He gave thanks for them also and told his disciples to distribute them. The people ate and were satisfied. Afterwards, the disciples picked up 7 basketfuls of broken pieces that were left over. About 4,000 were present after he had sent them away. He got into the boat with his disciples and went to the region of Dalmanutha. Dalmanutha is kind of a region. Magdala's in the region. Mary Magdalene is from. But so Jesus crosses over. But notice when Jesus feeds the crowd, does Jesus get the disciples together afterwards and go like, hey, did it work? Like, was there enough food? No, Jesus didn't ask the question. Jesus knew it was going to work. And notice, Jesus in the feeding of the 4,000, you have way too many people gathered, 4,000 people with way too little food, 7 loaves of bread for 4,000 people. Jesus multiplies the bread and the few small fish, and they feed 4,000 people on the hillside. So a whole bunch of people, real small amount of food. Jesus multiplies it and feeds everybody. This is what happens in the feeding at the beginning of chapter 8. Right after the feeding, right after Jesus feeds a large group of people with a small amount of food, Jesus and his disciples get back in that boat. They're headed to Dalmanutha. And on the way, on the Sea of Galilee, there's a discussion that happens in the boat. Let me show you the discussion. So the discussion is in verse 14. It says this. It says, the disciples had forgotten to bring bread, except for one loaf they had with them in the boat. Be careful, Jesus warned them. Watch out for the yeast of the Pharisees and that of Herod. So they feed 4,000 people, 7 loaves of bread. They get in the boat. The disciples realize, oh, shoot, we forgot to bring some bread. We don't have lunch. Jesus launches into this teaching. He says, beware of the yeast of the Pharisees and that of Herod. Jesus will use yeast often as like a metaphor. Anybody get like really into baking sourdough during COVID? Yeah. I got like all into it for like 3 weeks. I put on like 5 pounds and then I threw away the starter, right? That thing was dangerous. But yeast was something that in Jesus' world, you use every day. I lead trips over to Israel. We've got some friends over in Israel and they still think it's crazy that like we would go home and we buy bread for the week. They're like, we don't buy bread for the week. We buy bread for the day. If we need bread today, we buy bread today. If we need bread tomorrow, we buy bread tomorrow. Bread is a regular, ordinary part of life. In Jesus' world, yeast was something you use every day. And if you've ever used it, yeast is kind of fascinating. Like you take a dough, you add yeast to it, and yeast kind of below the surface, you don't really see it happening, but yeast ends up spreading and getting into all of the dough. So the entirety of it is changed because of the yeast. Jesus will often use that metaphor about kind of the teachings of a group of people. And so Jesus says, beware of the yeast, beware of the teachings of, and he names a couple groups, and this would also be a whole extra sermon, but just to like summarize it, yeast of the Pharisees. The Pharisees were essentially about legalism and self-righteousness. The yeast of that of Herod. There was a group of people called the Herodians who essentially they said, well, Rome is here and they're bigger than us and they're not going anywhere. And so we actually think that we can kind of cozy up to the way of Rome while also believing in our God. And Jesus is saying, hey, beware of both of those teachings. Because if you let that stuff in, so it's Pharisees is self-righteousness. It's about legalism. The Herodians is all about, yeah, cozying up to empire. It's about compromise, political compromise. And Jesus says, be careful of both of those. Because if you let them in, they could, those teachings have a way they could transform you into something you don't want to be. So Jesus warns them. And what we find next is that the disciples completely miss the point. They completely miss the point. This is what the disciples say. It says, they discussed this with one another and said, it's because we have no bread. The disciples think Jesus is talking about yeast because they forgot to bring bread along with them in the boat. They completely miss what Jesus is saying. They're worried that Jesus is kind of scolding them for forgetting to bring lunch. All they have is that one loaf of bread in the boat. Jesus will respond. And Jesus says this. He says, aware of their discussion, Jesus asks them, why are you talking about having no bread? do you not see or understand? Are your hearts hardened? Do you have eyes but fail to see and ears but fail to hear? And don't you remember when I broke the 5 loaves for the 5,000, that was a story that happened just a little bit earlier. When I broke the 5 loaves for the 5,000, how many basketfuls of pieces did you pick up? 12, they replied. And when I broke the 7 loaves for the 4,000, how many basketfuls of pieces did you pick up? They answered 7. He said to them, do you still not understand? Do you notice there's a statement Jesus makes that in light of where we started, to me, the first time I read it jumped off the page. Do you see the statement? It's right at the beginning. Jesus says, do you have eyes but fail to see? He's saying to his disciples, like, you're seeing what I'm doing, but you're not understanding what's happening. Like, you're seeing all the things that I'm doing, but you're still worried about lunch. If we put it on the timeline, Jesus feeds 4,000 people, way too many people with 7 loaves of bread, for way too many people with way too little food, feeds 4,000 with 7 loaves. They get in a boat, and immediately the disciples are like, oh no. We only have 1 loaf of bread amongst just the group of us. And Jesus is saying, did you not see what I just did? I just fed 4,000 people with 7 loaves of bread. We get into a boat and you're worried that we don't have enough bread because all we have is 1 loaf of bread for the group of us. Jesus is saying, you're seeing what I'm doing, but you're still not understanding who I am. Jesus will have this discussion in the boat. They'll get to the shore. And immediately what happens is the story we started with this morning. And so I want to read it again, but I want to read it kind of in context of the rest of the chapter. Pay attention to if anything jumps out. So it says, they came to Bethsaida. It's a fishing town on the Sea of Galilee. And some people brought a blind man and begged Jesus to touch him. He took the blind man by the hand and led him outside the village. When he had spit on the man's eyes and put his hands on him, Jesus asked, do you see anything? He looked up and said, I see people. They look like trees walking around. Once more, Jesus put his hands on the man's eyes. Then his eyes were opened, his sight was restored, and he saw everything clearly. So if we put it on our timeline, we have Jesus feeding 4,000 people with 7 loaves of bread. They immediately get into the boat. Jesus tries to give them a warning, but the disciples are worried that they don't have enough bread. Jesus says, do you see but not understand? And then immediately they get to the shore where Jesus will bring this blind man outside of the village. He will heal him so that he can see, but he doesn't quite understand what he's seeing. And then Jesus will give him his sight back. Did Jesus mess up? Is it because, like, Jesus is still learning? Is it because eyes are more complicated? I would argue what's happening is Jesus does exactly what he does because Jesus is teaching his disciples a lesson. Why bring him outside of the village? Not because Jesus is worried he's going to mess up in the village. Jesus brings the man outside of the village because this is a lesson his disciples need to see. It's a lesson his disciples need to learn, because I would argue Jesus is essentially telling his disciples that they are living like that blind man, that they're seeing what Jesus is doing, but it's not sinking in yet who Jesus is. They're seeing Jesus multiply 7 loaves of bread to feed 4,000 people, and yet they're worried when they only have 1 loaf of bread between them. Jesus is saying, you are like the blind man. You're seeing what I'm doing, but you're missing what I'm doing. You're missing who I am. You're seeing all this stuff, and yet it's not finding its way into you. It actually helps me make sense of what comes next, even in the timeline. There's a story. It's a popular story. We've kind of looked at it already a little bit in the series. But if we look back at that timeline, you have the feeding of the 4,000, the discussion in the boat, the healing of the blind man, and then immediately after Jesus heals this man, he's going to bring his disciples to the town of Caesarea Philippi. It's a really popular verse. I want to read it again, though, because I think it's helpful in light of the larger chapter. So it says, Jesus and his disciples went on to the villages around Caesarea Philippi. On the way, he asked them, "Who do people say that I am?" They replied, "Some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, still others one of the prophets." "But what about you?" he asked. "Who do you say I am?" Peter answered, "You are the Messiah. You are the Christos, the Christ. You are the King." So Peter, on the one hand, like, Peter gets it, right? Peter makes this incredible declaration. You're the Christ. You're the Messiah. And then what happens right next? It says, he then began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, and the teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and after 3 days rise again. He spoke plainly about this, and Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. And if we continue the story, this is the whole part where, like, Jesus will call Peter Satan and tell him to get behind him. But what's happening in the story is Peter is showing that he's continuing. He's seeing, but he's still not understanding. He has eyes, but he still doesn't get it. He's seeing who Jesus, he makes this incredible declaration, "You are the Messiah." And yet he still doesn't understand what that means. He sees it, but he still doesn't see it clearly. Jesus is teaching his disciples a lesson that you are like the blind man. And I think as I wonder, like, okay, why is the story important? Why is the story important? Well, I think for a number of reasons, but I think one of the most important parts about this story is Jesus is telling his disciples, and then I think through his disciples to us, that it's not enough just to simply know things about Jesus, right? Jesus wants his disciples to learn from him, but he wants them to learn from him so that they can grow into people that live like him. Jesus was a rabbi. He had disciples. The goal of a rabbi wasn't just that you teach your disciples. The goal was that your disciples end up becoming like you. They live the way that you do. And so Jesus is saying, it's not enough to simply know things happened if it doesn't influence the way that you actually live. And I think for us today, I think one of the reasons that's so important is I worry that in some ways we've reduced what it means to be a follower of Jesus, or we've reduced what it means to be a Christian to just a list of bullet point things that you have to believe, right? It's a list of bullet point things that you just have to assent to, affirm, that Christianity is something that just happens in our heads. And then this whole interesting thing happens when people disagree on what those bullet points are. Right? I mean, we've probably all seen moments where we all agree that Jesus says we should love our neighbor. But then, if you've watched, you've probably seen spaces where we agree that Jesus says we need to love our neighbor. But then you see people being incredibly nasty to one another about who is included when we talk about our neighbor. And you wonder, is it possible that when people are being terrible to one another over what it means to love our neighbor, maybe, just maybe, we've missed the point. That Jesus is saying, it's not enough. Yes, I want you to learn some things, but it's not enough just to know a bunch of things if it doesn't find its way into the way you live your life. It's one thing for me to believe that Jesus on that day, on that hillside, fed 4,000 people seven loaves of bread. I believe he did that. And yet, if I'm honest, how often do I still worry that I might not have enough? That I believe that Jesus provided, I believe Jesus can provide, I believe Jesus will provide. And yet, I worry about whether or not he will. Jesus wants the things that I know to be true about him to find their way into the way I live. And I think to Jesus, this was so important because Jesus knew that this is the way the world would change, that Jesus would take his disciples. And if his disciples got it, like if they went out, yes, sharing the stories of Jesus, but also creating disciples who are now not just knowing about Jesus, but are actually living out the ways and the words of Jesus. I think Jesus knew that it was in a group of people going out into the world, living the way of Jesus, that that would actually change the world. And I think we actually find in history that it happened. If we fast forward about 300 years, Rome has a new guy in charge. It's this guy. How great of a statue is that, right? Like, compared to like Dwayne Wade's little hall of, like, this thing's amazing. Flavius Claudius Julianus, he's the emperor. He's known as Julian the Apostate. You probably don't know this guy, but you probably know or have at least heard of the guy who comes before him. Flavius Claudius Julianus follows an emperor by the name of Constantine. And Constantine was a big deal because Constantine was the first Roman emperor who kind of made Christianity like the official religion of Rome. And so it wasn't just that they weren't being persecuted, the followers of Jesus weren't being persecuted. Constantine kind of made Christianity the religion of Rome. Flavius Claudius Julianus, Julian the Apostate, would follow Constantine and in a lot of ways wanted to kind of undo all of the things that Constantine did, especially around Christianity. He's known Julian the Apostate because he opposed the way of Jesus. He wanted to undo Constantine's decisions. He actually really even wanted to bring persecution back on the Christians, except he ran into a problem. There was something that made what he wanted to do difficult in the empire, and I'll let him say it in his own words. He says, "Those Christians," he said, "take better care of Romans who are in need than we do. They not only take care of their own, but they care for any Roman, Christian or not." He wanted to stamp out the movement. But what he found is it was really hard to stand against a movement that everybody else loved. The thing that made it hard for him is the empire, the people loved what it meant to have followers of Jesus among them. Because in their world, the followers of Jesus, they weren't just debating theology, they were actually also feeding the hungry, right? They were helping the needy. They were being good news. I love the quote for what it meant in their world. And in some ways, I also lament some of what the church is known for today in ours. And it makes me wonder, like, what if we could get back to that? Right? Where the world around us, the communities around us, they look at the church and say, we are better. We're better. Whether we believe that stuff yet or not, we're better because they exist. Jesus knew it wasn't enough just to know some things if it didn't impact the way that his followers actually lived their lives. And so it caused me to ask the question, as I kind of like wrestle with the story, I can't help but look at my life and wonder, in what ways in my life am I like that blind man? Right? In what ways am I, like I said earlier, like I believe that Jesus fed 4,000 people, and yet I wonder how I'm going to make it. Where are the things where what I believe is true about who Jesus is, about who God is, where that doesn't quite reconcile with the way I live my life? Where am I like the blind man? Because I think it's one of the tasks, one of the call. If you're here and you call yourself a follower of Jesus, I think one of the things that we're called to do is try to reconcile that, try to shrink that gap as much as we can, so that the things that we believe to be true also shape the way that we live. And I'll close with, it's a story. I guess it's kind of a story, but it's back when I was in seminary. At the end of seminary, you have to write this like capstone paper. It's called a credo. A credo in Latin just means I believe. And so it's this long paper about what you believe about a certain number of topics. And for me, this kind of project will always live in my brain, and not because of the credo I wrote. I don't think I could even find the credo I wrote. That thing's done and gone. But I had a peer, somebody I did seminary with. The way they started their credo will live with me forever. I'm going to paraphrase. I didn't exactly memorize it, but his credo essentially started by saying, I want to be clear. What follows in this paper is a bunch of information about what I think about certain topics. But if you want to know what I actually believe, You should actually follow me around and watch the way I live my life. Hey, if you want to know what I think about generosity, oh yeah, keep reading. It's in the paper. But if you want to know what I actually believe about generosity, you should pay attention to the way I steward the resources that I have oversight over. If you want to know what I think about forgiveness, oh yeah, keep reading. It's in like chapter 3. But if you want to know what I actually believe about forgiveness, you should watch the way I interact with the people that have hurt me. If you want to know what I think about what it means to love my neighbor and who is my neighbor, yeah, keep reading the paper. But if you want to know what I believe, you should pay attention to the way I interact with people online, even maybe the people that I disagree with. You should see the way that I interact with my family and the people around me. If you want to know what I think, yeah, keep reading. But if you want to know what I believe, you actually need to watch my life. Because again, for Jesus, it wasn't enough just to know a bunch of things if those things didn't shape the way his followers lived. After all, when Jesus is walking by the Sea of Galilee that day, right, he sees Peter, Andrew, James, and John, two sets of brothers on the shoreline. Jesus didn't simply ask them to believe in him. That would come later. What Jesus asks is that they would follow. What Jesus asks is that they would uproot their lives, that they would follow him so that they would learn from him in order to become like him. I think that's the call for us today, to shrinking that gap, to giving our lives to trying to follow even more closely so that we might not just know more about our rabbi, about Jesus, the one we follow, but our lives would actually model his. Would you pray with me? God, we do pray that you would open our eyes to the things in our lives where there is a gap between what we believe to be true and the way that we actually live our lives. God, we pray that we might model our lives after yours, that you would show us the areas that we need to work on. And God, we pray that your church might go out into this, your world, the way that it has before, the way that we know it can and will again, to partner with you in furthering your kingdom here on earth as it is in heaven. We pray this all in Jesus' name. Amen.